with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Frank B., who will be talking mainly about throwing dice with an advantage. You'll get more out of the discussion if you have a pair of dice in front of you. So those of you who are listening to this on some sort of a tape delay, maybe it's better if you can stop the tape, go get yourself a pair of dice, and then start over again. We'll be talking to Frank in a few minutes. We've spoken about the Revel promotion at length. For all players who weren't determined to be ineligible, however much you lost in July at machine games, they'll be rebated in 20 equal installments starting the first week in August, which is this week. If anybody wants to share their experiences about collection of the rebate, whether it's gone smoothly or whatever, please email us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Inquiring minds want to know. Also, at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, we got an email recently that asked about casinos giving away airfare rebates. Someone thought it sounded pretty cool and wanted to know how much he needed to play in order to get in on some of that. This is definitely not a one-size-fits-all formula. Every casino does it a bit differently, and every casino changes its criteria over time. And different people within a casino do it differently than other people in that same casino. So while we can't give you an exact formula, we can provide some broad parameters. All casino rebates, including airfare, are fueled by either your theoretical loss or your actual loss. And by actual loss, we mean what the casinos think you lost. In some games, there are ways to inflate this number so the casinos think you lost more than you actually have. In video poker, we used to be able to do this by card pulling. That loophole has pretty well been closed. But some players have found ways to overstate their losses in other games. We're not going to provide you a blueprint on how to do this, but if you think long and hard enough, you just might be able to come up with some ways on your own. Once the casino has your loss figure, either theoretical or actual, depending on which ones they use, they're only going to give you a rebate on a certain percentage of that. Maybe 10%, 20%, 30%, something like that, depending on what jurisdiction you're in. The casino is, after all, attempting to make a profit, and so they're not going to give away all their profits. This rebate to the player has to cover all of the player goodies. If you've earned a total of $1,000 in rebates, but you're staying in a suite that bills $500 a night and you eat at comp meals at the best restaurants, there's no money to pay for the airfare. If you've earned the same $1,000 rebates, but you stay in a standard room and eat in a coffee shop or buffet, there might be quite a bit of room for the airfare. Generally speaking, the host gives you the airfare. Each casino has some guideline rules, but individual hosts have wide leeway. Therefore, your personal relationship with a host matters a lot when it comes to the rebates. The care and feeding of host is an art. It pays to cultivate those relationships. Now, there are people who could sell ice cubes to Eskimos. Those people can get all kinds of airfare reimbursements because they're just good at these things. There are some people around whom prostitutes play hard to get. Those people are going to pay for their own airfare. There's this negotiation that has to go on, and some people are better than others. you generally have to ask in order to get. If you don't ask, you don't get. If you do ask, well, maybe. If you've had an extra big loss, now's the time to ask for a lot more than you usually do. Hosts are sympathetic to big losses and to try to ease your pain if they can. They want you to come back and have another big loss. So then you ask for airfare reimbursement. If you've had an extra big win, don't press if the host tells you that that's a problem, because some casinos have rules saying you have to lose this time in order to get airfare reimbursement. If you play three or four casinos the same trip, most players have no problem with asking for the same airfare rebate at each of the casinos. Now, a casino itself might say, this is unfair. You only flew once. Why should you collect four times? And the players would say, well, if I earn the rebate four times, I should get it four times. Most of us can see both sides of that argument. But advantage players, if they're entitled to the rebate, they go for it. Do you have anything to add to this, Richard?
Yeah, I would say it's a lot more than just asking. The people who are really willing to grind and whine and just not take no for an answer are going to do a lot better than the people who, you know, if the host says, no, I can't do it, they go, okay, and walk away. The other thing is, not all hosts are created equal. So if you have a low-level host who tells you he can't give you the money, then get a better host and get a host that's higher up the food chain. I had a casino that I used to play at a lot where I was not happy with what I was getting from the host I had. And I, you know, the next time I called, I said, I want a new host. I don't like this guy. He's not, you know, performing for me. So don't be afraid to do that. The other thing is, airfare and other cash comps have just really gone way downhill since the big recession. Back in 2007, if you had at least a $10,000 loss, you might be able to get 7% of your loss in airfare reimbursement. Now a lot of them won't comp airfare at all with under a $20,000 loss. Some of them, as you say, will just say, you have to lose. If you had a winning trip, it doesn't matter what your Theo was. They wanted at least a $250 average bet. But it's gone down to where sometimes it's as low as 3% of your loss. Now, if you're a player who gets up into the $100,000 range, now you're going to get your airfare no matter what. And in fact, you'll probably get show up money. So again, it's all part of the negotiation, and the more you grind on them, the more they'll give you. And as far as collecting at three or four different places, part of my pitch to them was, hey, I didn't use a penny in comps. I didn't use a room. I didn't have a meal, nothing. It cost you nothing. And I had this big loss here. So, and they'd say, well, I know you're getting your airfare over at whatever casino I told them I was staying. But still, if I argued and grinded them and whined about it like a big loser, I would usually get it. So, that's the story there. Frank, you have anything to add to that?
Hi, Bob. Hi, Richard. On the airfare, I don't do a whole lot of that, so I don't have a whole lot to add there. But I did hear some things on the Rebel thing, if you want to touch on that.
Go for it.
Okay, I don't know what you anticipated, Bob, but I'm hearing that the coupons that show up, you know, everybody got 20 of them, at 500 or more, they differ from the ones below 500 in that you have to go and get a host to sign off on it and then load it up for you.
Wow.
That's something I know a lot of guys were hoping was not going to be the case.
Well, yeah, some people were hoping to
Right.
cash in on their spouse's coupon as well, and their
right.
neighbors, and their blah, blah.
The other thing that I heard is that, and this is just from a couple guys, and they played it on the square. They didn't try to inflate or anything. They got the amount wrong. They got the amount of the loss wrong.
By a significant amount?
Yes.
In their favor or against them?
Well, one in one direction and one in the other.
Yeah.
In other words, one guy won, he's getting coupons.
So this is presumably an error in their software or something, a glitch.
If
it's in both directions, it does not sound like it's in intentionally the casinos trying to screw the players. It sounds like some kind of mistake.
Well, and traditionally, the casinos have always been really horrible at keeping track of wins and losses. So, I mean, this doesn't surprise me
true.
At all.
All right. Good. All right. Thanks for the feedback. There was an interesting case involving cheating players at the Mohegan Sun concerning baccarat. The players paid the dealers to press their thumbs into sevens, eights, and nines when they came across them. This is a little bit similar to the Phil Ivey case. The next time through the deck, if the player spotted that the first card was going to be one of these cards with the pressing marks on it, the players bet big. The players won several hundred thousand dollars and were eventually arrested for cheating. The dealers testified at the trial and were given immunity to testify at the trial, and the players were basically caught red-handed. Here's the twist. In Connecticut, it's illegal to mark cards, but it's not illegal to play in a game where somebody else has marked the cards. Since the dealers had immunity, if they testified, they were fine, and the seemingly guilty players were legally not guilty due to the technicality of the law. So the players got off scot-free, except they were banned from playing at the casino, which is a relatively small price to pay. I see this as over-the-line behavior on the player's part. How do you see it, Richard?
Well, you know, this is a really interesting question. I mean, yeah, if the players paid off the dealers to do the markings, then yeah, it's clearly, I mean, they're cheating and it's over the line and just kind of shows you that the, you know, Connecticut didn't know what they were doing when they wrote the law. But I have been in situations where I've been on a table and noticed markings on the cards. And so now, if I wasn't involved in marking the cards, you know, is that something you would play? In my own case, if it were a game like baccarat or a face-up blackjack game where I never touched the cards, I would go ahead and play that. If it were, say, a carnival game, you know, like three-card poker or something, I would get up and leave just because I would be afraid that I would be accused of being the one who marked the cards. So, you know, I would have no qualms about playing it as long as I was not the one who marked them and I just happened to pick up on it.
Frank, have you had any experience in this kind of thing?
Well, you know, something Richard said, you know, like him, if I'm on a table and I see that there's already something wrong with the card, I just point it out. I say, you know, let's do the new, because you don't want to catch anything, you know, down the road where they think that you had something to do with it. So just point it out and get it taken care of. But as far as these guys go, it sounds like they got pretty lucky. I mean, conspiracy to cheat, isn't it?
Yeah, in Nevada it certainly would be. And I wonder if that law will get changed very quickly.
I would think by Tuesday. But now, we got an email from somebody at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. A few shows ago, Richard, you talked about a counter catcher who watches you real closely when you come into the casino, basically in order to verify that you're up to no good or too good for the house and kicks you out. Now, so the guy wrote in and said he thought he found one in a casino, so he left immediately. But what kind of cover do you employ when you think there's a counter catcher there?
So it's actually great for the player if they have a counter catcher. This is pretty common in Atlantic City. It used to be that the bosses at the Barbary Coast were trained how to count. So you would know when the guy was there counting you down. So if you know when you're being counted down, it's very easy to make yourself look like not a counter by, you know, at the Barbary Coast, my favorite thing to do was wait until I had 20 and the dealer had 20, so it was four tens on the board, and double my bet. And they would see that and invariably just turn around and walk away once they saw that. So yeah, if there's a counter catcher watching you play, just play badly and let them see you play badly until they walk away. You know, unfortunately now most of the counter catching is being done from the eye in the sky where you have no idea when they're watching you. So it makes it a much harder thing to do to get away with.
Well, doubling your bet when the count goes negative by -4 or -8, depending on what system you're using, is an expensive process, isn't it?
Oh, not really. I mean, so you give up a percent on that hand, you know, but it buys you an extra few hours of play.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't really cost you much.
Very good. Do you have any experience with this, Frank, before we introduce you?
Oh, yeah.
We could talk about this all day, huh?
Right, sure. Certainly you don't want to do anything that would stand out, you know, like Richard's play of, you know, put a little extra money on there when it's obviously the cow just went south would be one thing. You know, maybe taking even money on insurance when it's obvious in the same type of spot. It's basically you just shut everything down and you're not making any moves. You're not moving your bets. You're just flat betting and playing basic strategy. There's not much else you can do.
Actually, I would make some basic strategy errors too. Like I would not hit soft 18 against a 9 or a 10 if the guy was standing there. Or
that's what I was going to say. Don't play 8-7 right. You know, just play that very that one in insurance. You know, those, you know, the obvious tip offs that we're all aware of.
Or 10-2 against a 2.
Right.
All right. So, Munchkin, why don't you introduce this guy in the background who keeps interrupting the show?
So, Frank is an all-around advantage player from blackjack to slots to video poker to sports betting and many other things. I first became aware of him when something he wrote for Blackjack Forum many, many years ago. So I'm really happy that we have him here tonight. So, Frank, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks again, guys.
So the main reason we have you here is for a while, you had a lot of experience practicing dice control, running experiments, and attempting to beat the house throwing dice. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it's been several years. And there was a point, you know, around 2004 or 2005, that the whole dice control thing started to, there was a little explosion of interest in that. And apparently had been going on for a while, but it was the type of thing you ignored because of the people who were involved in it. But when Stanford Wong got interested in it, then a lot of guys started to take a look at it. And because I had some access to him, you know, like you, Bob, I had a, I think I covered the exact same route that you did. I did the CBGN thing, south side of town and all that, for several years. But
that is the Casino Blackjack News checked how many decks were in each casino and what the rules are. So that's what he's referring to. Go ahead.
All right. So I had been doing some things with members of a blackjack team that was out of town, and they were interested in this as well. So we decided that we were going to collaborate on it and try and investigate this, because you could see the potential for it. You know, the things that were possible, if any of this was true, you know, what they were claiming. So we decided to use my house for the whole thing in Vegas. And I went out and it was decided right away that the way that these groups that give these lessons out and do these seminars, the way that they go about things is, They cut corners all over the place, with the equipment primarily. You know, you'll go to these things and they'll have you throwing into some kind of handmade wooden box. So we thought that, you know, number one, we need to get a real craps table. So I went out and I had to go. It wasn't easy to do either. You got to go to these providers that are used to dealing with casinos and tell them that you want, you know, a craps table for personal use and you want certain specifications. And I had a friend who knew one of the guys that was supplying the win, and they were in the process of making about, I don't know, 12 or 15 tables for the win, and I got in there and talked to him, And I said, well, just make me one just like the Wynn, because he had the Wynn were using 12-foot tables. And table size, I thought, was going to be real important, because we wanted to do our practice from the same distance and only from one distance. So the fluctuation in table size ranges from, I think they, well, you know, you see outside of little tubs, they start at about 10 feet, and I think there's 11s, and then 12 is the overwhelming majority of tables in town. Over 50% of the tables are 12 foot, and there are some 14s. So we had a 12-foot table built, and it took some time. And while that was going on, we decided we definitely needed a program. So we had a guy who was good with that stuff. He wrote a tracking program for our throws that we were going to be training. And that took a while as well. And in the interim, we just tried to gather up as much information as possible from what was out there, which were these groups like Scobletti and them.
Scobletti has a Golden Touch school.
Yeah, which I hear he just retired or something from that.
Uh-huh, okay.
There's a handful of them out there. So we got the table and we started training. We had the program written and we started recording rolls. And a few things had to be, you know, just logically, we decided that there was, for left-handed players and for right-handed players, there was a one specific position at the table you should be standing and none other. So if you're right-handed, you're going to stand just to the left of the stick man, and vice versa, if you're left-handed, you stand just right to the of the stick man. And so all our throws are going to be from that distance, and we just started recording.
So are you throwing backhanded, so to speak, across the stick man's body?
If you're leaning over the table, your right hand is like right next to the left arm of the dealer, and you're grabbing a dice and you're just, you're throwing them towards the wall. So it's not bad. That would have been the other thing. If you'd have stood on the other side of the dealer, you had to sort of twist your body and contort it to make that throw. And also, your arm, when you throw, it's going to sort of go right in front of the stick man, and it's the shortest distance possible to throw the dice on the table.
So basically,
any other place you stand, you're throwing it a longer distance.
So your hip is basically touching the table when you throw.
Yeah. You're funny. Your waist. Yeah, you're leaning over.
Good. All right.
You're square.
Yeah, so, that's counterintuitive to me, because I would have thought if you were right-handed and you stood to the right of the stick man and stood perpendicular to the table and put your right side against the table, your arm would be kind of swinging in a natural arc as opposed to kind of sidearm if you're...
Yeah, well, it really isn't the case, because when you stand to the right for a right-hander, you have to do a kind of a body twist, and you're all stretched out and everything. You think about it, when your hands are down at your sides and they're laying there, you know, which way, if you just extend your arm out, it's a natural throw. All you got to do is lean over and make that throw. So we were pretty convinced that was the way to go. You know?
All right,
and
let's
and
move
the
on.
The ideal setup would have been have a lefty and a righty on the same table. So accumulating all these rolls, you know, we start to examine the data and, you know, we start to see some results. You know, along the way, you're always tinkering with your throw, so you're never quite sure if you've sort of morphed out of something and into something else. So it was important to get as consistent as quickly as possible with your throw and then just accumulate data so you can look at it, because that was the only way we were going to know if anything was going on. You can't take it, you know, any of this stuff on faith. And we put in a lot of hours and kept up a pretty good pace. I mean, we're talking a couple months before we actually ever went into the casino to throw.
So how many hours a day would you practice? I mean, how many throws a day? Or,
well, you can get off, you know, with you know, after every throw, you got to click in the result. And we were getting off about 100 throws an hour. And at first, we were overdoing it. We were going like 4 hours a day with throws. And it really, it sounds ridiculous, but we started to develop certain what do they call it, repetitive stress injuries. You know, you had problems with your feet, you had problems with your elbow, your thumb. So we had to back off a little, but we ended up about 2 hours a day for a good stretch.
Huh.
So the data, when it finally started to accumulate to where it was a significant amount, the sample was something you could look at and attach standard deviations to it, we started to notice the SRR did go up. And if nobody knows what if people don't understand what the SRR is, a random SRR, which stands for 7 to rolls ratio, is 6.0. In other words, you throw the dice, you got every sixth throw, you're going to throw a 7. So that was one statistic that was kept. That was rising. And as the program was refined and new columns were added to keep track of different things and calculate things out, we started to notice that certain combinations were coming up a little more frequently than they should. But the one thing that stood out was, there's 36 different combinations that the dice can land on. And
permutations, not combinations.
Right. And once we started to sort these, and you would see the frequency of, the 4-3, the 5-2, whatever, the one at the bottom that it was significantly less occurring than any other combination was the combination that was on the inside of the dice. So when you set the dice on the table, you're pushing them together and they're touching. Those two die faces that are touching, that thing was pretty much off the charts as far as not showing up. And when I say that, I'm saying it was occurring more than 20%, less than 80% of what it should.
That's significant.
And
what set were you using? Dice throwers seem to make a very big deal about their sets, the way they set the dice. So what set were you using to try to take advantage of that?
Well, okay, like I say, these things develop. You start to notice these things, and you start to say, well, we want to go further with this and try to prove that this is going to maintain. But the dice set for the program was what they call the hard ways, and it always had to be threes on top, one to the left, and then you entered, and we had the dice were you could tell the left from the right because of the way we would either mark the dice or we'd use two different colored dice. Prefer to use two dice from the same set and just mark them.
So your inside faces would be a 6 and an ace.
Right. And that's what the dice people refer to as double off axis, double pitch. In other words, both dice went off axis, and one die moved two, supposedly. This is the way they see it. It's not really that way. But it's one dice flipped upside down on the other. So, in other words, it's the most negatively correlated thing that could happen from the original dice set.
I see.
So if 6-1 is 20% less likely to happen than normal, then sevens as a group would be, since that is one-third of the sevens, then that would mean sevens as a group is 7% less likely to happen. Is that reasonable?
Well, see, what we were trying to figure out is if there was anything that might be universal from one person, from one thrower to another. Now the guys I got involved with this, there was another guy that was throwing and accumulating throws at a real good clip. Actually, he had more throws than me. And when I showed him this, I said, look at my distribution of the results here. Look at the 6-1. It's random would be 2.78, and mine was below 2.2. I go, and it sort of makes a little bit of sense. And then we looked at his, and out of the 36 combinations, that was also his least occurring combination.
Well, that can't
be.
Then
we're going, wow, I think we might have something here.
Well, that actually can't be. The doubles or something would be only half as likely.
Well, no, because we're sorting left, right.
You're talking about the 1-6 where the 1 on a particular die and the 6 on the other die.
6 on the left die and the 1 on the right die, yeah.
Okay.
Now, we also had a function that would sort every die face, the left die and the right, and you could see how many times each face was coming up on each side. Now, the interesting thing is, it was not a case of those die faces just occurring less frequently and therefore the combination was coming up less frequently. It's just that they were not occurring together. The 6 was coming up 17.1% of the time. Random would be 16.67, so that 6 on the left eye was coming up a little more often than it should. The 1 was coming up 16.3%, so that was coming up a little less. But we also had a column that would calculate your theoretical number of occurrences based on the dye faces that were showing, you know, what was showing the distribution. And theoretical said that we should be throwing 3.5% more of the 6-1 combination than random. So, you know, you start to put all these things together, and it starts to get real interesting and a strong indication that the two were pretty negatively correlated.
Okay, so let's move on a little bit. You potentially have a beatable system when you're throwing in your living room. Could
right.
you translate that to the casino?
Right, that's a real difficult thing to do. And that is one of the things that, like, when people ask me about this, you know, they're looking at advice about how to get started on it. And there's, like, there's 3 or 4 things I say. This is the most important thing. Don't get, you know, wander off into a different direction. Just understand these things. The table is the single most important aspect of this whole deal. The table surfaces, they vary greatly, and you could be the most polished, most mechanical thrower that there is out there, and if you're on a bad table, the dice are just going to move like crazy when they hit.
By bad table, you mean the felt is too new, or the surface is too soft, or there's ridges on it, or what makes a bad surface?
What makes a bad surface is how the dice react when they first strike. Some tables that they have a tendency to sort of die, the action dissipates quickly, and some they just bounce like crazy. And it has, you know, there's a lot to it. It's what they do under the table. You know, there's all kinds of different things you can put under the felt. Sometimes the felt goes flat on the wood. Sometimes they put some kind of slate under there. They'll put newspaper under there. You know, the Wind, when they put their tables in, they put some type of carpet foam under there, and you could bounce the dice off the table every time. The table surfaces varied greatly, and part of the deal eventually was to figure out where the good tables were and just play those, because, you know, it's all about minimizing the action after first strike.
And what percentage of tables were actually good? In your mind, what percentage of tables was actually playable?
Well, I think it would probably be 20-25%. We never got. We just had a list of tables that, you know, this place has good tables, and in some cases it was the place had mediocre tables, but they had one superstar table, or something like that. You know, you just had to go, and we had developed different ways to go in there and test the table. You know, we had different counts. You'd go in there, and you just have to hit your mark and see how they react and start. I understand that we're getting bogged down in minutia here, and I don't want to further that by telling you about all these little systems we had for testing the table. But suffice to say that we had a way of going in there, and in about 50 throws, we could tell we had a way to rate that table and comparing it to the control table that was in my house.
Okay, so you had about 20-25% of the tables in town were playable.
That's a lot of tables.
Yeah, probably around 20%.
Yeah. So that's a lot of tables.
Yeah. You know,
so the money just rolled in.
No, the money didn't just roll in. We did start out, when we finally got around, I'm going to skip over a whole bunch of stuff. When we finally got around to getting out there and playing, we started doing pretty well. And we started ramping up the bets, and we got more efficient. You know, we want to play at this place, it's the time to show up. You show up right away. You tell them to put a bigger sign on there. You keep everybody off. Because if you can imagine, if you got a table with 10 people at it and you get to shoot once every, you know, you got to wait for the other 9 people to shoot, that's not a good situation.
Right.
Plus their chips get in the way of your throw.
Well, that we had a blocker. We would have a blocker down at the landing area. And it was his job to make sure that a bunch of chips weren't in the way. And generally the target zone was beyond that pass line. But you want somebody random standing there and doing who knows what behind the pass line. In other words, you can't bet. You don't want them putting odds down and things like that. So you know, different things were learned along the way. Like, there's two different sizes of dice. You know, didn't know that when we started out, but, you know, obviously the bigger ones are better.
When the casinos discovered that you were winning and keep coming back, how did they react to the situation? What did they do to change the conditions or something?
Well, you know, the casinos, just like you experience when you have to deal with them on a constant basis, is they're very reactive to results. So if you went into a place and you lost, it wasn't uncommon for the box man to be goofing on you and laughing at you, and we got heckled a lot. But if you won and you came back and you won more, they were pretty quick to start to think that maybe there was something to it. Most of them didn't believe there was anything to it. That's why they let you do it. Overall, it would take repeated showing up at the same place and beating them for a decent amount. And you tended to have to do that because what you were doing is you were targeting certain tables. So you were going back to the same places over and over again. It did eventually end up, I did end up getting barred at about half a dozen places. And of course, just about all of them were the places that I needed to play at.
And your teammates, if that's the right word, presumably used the same throwing technique. And so your technique became pretty obvious after a while, I suspect. So
yeah,
unlike
blackjack, it's difficult to disguise what you're doing. You know, you go in there, and if you spent all these hours doing this, you look very robotic. And if you start getting results, it can be pretty intimidating. Like, look at this guy; he's coming in here. He looks polished. He looks like he's been doing this for a while, and he's winning. And like I said, they were very reactive to that at certain places. Some places it really pained them to have to tell you. You know, they were puzzled that they had to tell you that, you know, you can't throw dice here anymore. Because I think going in, they almost universally thought that these guys that are showing up doing this, we don't have to worry about them. They're great for business.
When you throw, do your dice hit the wall?
Okay, yeah, that was a big difference in opinion of as far as Stanford and I and the target area. Most of the guys, just about all of them, they advocate and they teach, because that's their business. They're teaching people how to do this, that the first strike occurs 6 to 10 inches from the wall. Now, Richard has seen the same video that I saw about halfway through this project of the dice super slow-mo down. And I'll be honest, if I had seen that before I got started with this, I probably wouldn't even have attempted it, because it looks like the dice are in a blender. So my throw actually is, the target zone is 1 to 3 inches from the wall. And the reason for that is, if you're on the right table, which has a dead surface, when it gets down there, it tends to die. It doesn't necessarily always hit the wall. Now, when you're going for that target zone of 6 to 10 inches away, often you come up short of the wall, and you're going to get warned. And you're going to get warned repeatedly, but listen, you're not hitting the wall, and you're not trying to hit the wall. And, you know, the worst thing that can happen is when they start threatening you, you know, if you miss the wall again, we're going to call a no throw. And you can't have that. You can't have them free-rolling you like that, because I guarantee you, if you miss the wall and you're seven out, that's not the no throw. It's when you make your point, or, you know, they're going to lose some money. So as soon as somebody said that to me and I thought they were serious, I would stop throwing. Because, you know, you just can't let them free roll you like that. But that's part of the reason six to ten inch distance. And the other reason that they tell you 6 to 10 inches, and this is just my opinion of the people that I encountered that were teaching this, was that that's an easy throw to make. And it's not difficult to do that. You can pull some guy that's in town for 3 weeks. He signed up for your seminar, and in an hour you can have him hitting that mark. Try hitting 1 to 3 inches from the wall without hitting the wall. That's not an easy shot. And
right.
You know, the 6 to 10 inch thing, I never agree with it because, I mean, the dice, as soon as the dice strike 8 inches from the wall, then they go into that chaotic state for the rest of the time. You hit 2 inches from the wall, they immediately encounter, hopefully, the underside of the bottom row of diamonds, and they just seem to come to rest a lot faster with that method. And I know most of the guys out there throwing don't like that, but I think that has more to do that they can't make that shot the same way they can make that 6 to 10 inch shot.
So is your overall conclusion that it's not worth it to spend the time getting good at this? Because even if they, because you won't get that profitable and then they'll kick you out if you are. Is that your conclusion?
It's a difficult thing to execute, and the setup, listen, I'm a full-time sports bettor, but my primary season is football. So when Super Bowl is over, I took this up. And I said, okay, I want to do this, you know, for as long as it takes this summer, and I'll get back into football. It ended up being about a one-year deal from start to when we finally got thrown out of the place with the best table. And 3-4 months before we're even throwing for money. I mean, it's a huge commitment of time, and if you go about it the wrong way, you know, the reason that I, talk to guys about it and they ask me is, you know, I'm trying to save them a lot of time and energy by, you know, by not making a few certain mistakes. You know, one of them being the equipment. Don't cut corners with that. But also what you're getting yourself into here. I mean, this is not something that you can just practice an hour a day for a couple weeks and then go out there and think that you have a throw that is consistent enough to do this. In the statistics, the things that would show up, do they translate from the table you're practicing? I mean, there's so many ifs about this that after a while, it just wasn't worth. I mean, it basically was a full-time job for almost a year.
Did you guys end up making money?
Yeah, what happened is we started out very well, and the guys on the blackjack team, you know, one of them was a manager, and you know, I wasn't part of that team, but we were collaborating on this. They eventually, after looking at the statistics and then the results, they authorized bankroll money to be used for throwing craps. So this guy was allowed to go out and throw craps on the blackjack money, which I thought I was a little surprised that they okayed that. But yeah, we made money. I'm not sure what their end result was because there was debate within the group whether they should be taking action on the craps, because when you get involved with that, one thing that we decided was necessary is you had to include the back end of the craps play. In other words, you go play blackjack and you really don't care about comps, you really don't care about mail, you don't care about, you know, any part of exploiting the marketing department. But on the craps, we calculated that if you did this properly and you played sessions the proper way at the proper places using the card, the back end pretty much covered the house advantage that you had if you were just wasting your time and throwing randomly. So it was, in that respect, it was sort of a free roll that you were accomplishing anything. But to have a blackjack and say, listen, you need to use ID, you need to use a player card, and you need to get the mail, and that mail has got to be part of the bottom line. That was how that's the way they went about it. But how they ended up, I'm not sure if they came out ahead. I ended up at my high point was about plus 50,000, and when I gave it up, I was in the 30s. So I had been on a slide during football season, I guess.
Mm.
All right, we got about. We actually have a ton more questions, so you're going to have to come back and talk to us again, Frank. That's just it. They're just, we will not accept a no answer.
Yeah, during football season, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we may have to wait till after football season. But if we have time, you know, one of the things that we pride ourselves on is talking about ways to beat all different games in the casino. So, you know, could you tell us about beating the Big Six?
In a two-minute version.
Okay, Big Six wheel. This is way back when. This is that, I can say where it's at now because it's gone. It was at Sahara, and a friend and I were cruising through there, and they had a Big Six wheel, and next to it, I guess it had a sign that said something like, "You can spin the wheel if you want," something like that. And so we went to dinner and talked about it. I said, we could go out there if they're really going to let you spin it time after time. Well, your first spin's not going to be so good, but your second spin is going to be better, and it's just going to keep getting better from that. We'll see how it goes. Set some small amounts, and if you really are getting close to the jokers, start betting big. So anyway, we got out there, and that's what we did. They let him. We decided I'd bet, he'd spin. They let him spin the wheel, and they let him spin it repeatedly because nobody else wanted to spin it. So it took, you know, it's been a while, but it took half a dozen or so spins to see that he was getting his groove. And once he did, I start betting on the Sahara symbol or whatever it was. And he was coming close. He was coming close, but he wasn't hitting them. But he was hitting the stuff right around it. And I noticed that right around it, the distribution was not even. It wasn't like a 2, a 5, a 1, or a 20. You know, they have to space them out in the increments based on the denomination. But there was a bunch of 2s surrounding, more than one, more than every other. A little more than every other was a 2 surrounding the wheel, or surrounding the jackpot symbol. So I said, I just said, I'm betting on 2, and I'm betting on the jackpot, and we went from there. And we started to slowly grind away on that 2, because you're betting 50 bucks or whatever. I can't remember. I really don't remember the amount we were betting. But I do know on the first time he hit the Sahara symbol, we cleaned the rack out. And that took, because they don't put a lot in those big 6 wheels. It's just, you know, I don't know, it might be $1,000 in there. Then they took a long time, and they made the fill. And we're waiting around, and just filled it. Finally get to make the bet again. He gives it another spin. Bam, nailed it again, back to back. And that was pretty much it. They took a long time to pay, and it required another fill. So it took a long time for them to bring the chips, but as they were doing that, I could see that something was up. It's that familiar gathering of suits in a corner, talking and looking at you. And I was not stuck there because they had paid me off the previous rack, and the new rack was going to be paying my partner.
So you left.
I bailed on him. Yeah, I left him there.
What a buddy.
Yeah, and they were in hot pursuit, and they did catch up to me because I didn't go to the cage. I had a bunch of chips, a lot of them red, and I just made a beeline for the door, sort of, because I saw him standing over at the cage, and they got me outside, and they just said, hey, you know, we don't want you coming back here, all that kind of stuff. And I left and got a hold of my friend. He got the same business, you know, when he finally got paid. And if there's enough time, there's a second part to that, because about 2 years later, downtown, Binion's had a promotion where you would play machines, you would get drawing tickets, and if you got pulled, you got to spin this wheel that had some good stuff on it, and the top prize was a car. Now, we were playing this and accumulating tickets and putting them in the drawing for the weekly drawing, and in the middle of the night, though, Binion's was kind of loose with everything they did in the casino, and they would just park this wheel up against the wall, like, you know, where the Mick wall used to be.
So you could practice.
And, yeah, so in the middle of the night, we would go in there, and we were just practicing. Sometimes we were betting each other. Yeah, I bet, you know, how many shots to hit the Joker, that kind of thing. But we were developing. I knew exactly where I wanted the Joker positioned for my spin, because the only minimum requirement is that the thing made one revolution. So drawing night comes around, and I think they're picking 5 names, and they pull me, and comes time for me to spin. And I know that if I line up the Joker at 3 o'clock, which is basically 1 1/4 revolutions, that was sort of my sweet spot. And they let me mess with the wheel, you know, position the Joker over at 3 o'clock, or the car. In this case, they had taken a big 6 wheel and overlaid the prizes, so this is where the car was. And I gave it a spin, and I nailed it dead on. For the car. And it's probably only really occurred to us to practice that is because of what happened over at the Sahara. So that was part 2 of that.
That's interesting. All right. Thank you, Frank B. We're going to have you on again, maybe not till after football season, or maybe before football season, but something soon. Sooner better than later. Let's talk about our sponsors. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. They have daily drawings for $25,000 at 8:10 p.m. in the Grandview Lounge. There's one prize of $10,000 and 15 prizes of $1,000 each. If you get called first and you're there within 4 minutes, you get the $10,000. Otherwise, you get demoted to $1,000 and somebody else is called. I did not check last night, but in the first 6 nights, all 6 first name calls were there. So people are hanging around for this drawing. If you get on the 1,000, you have 24 hours to pick it up. To earn tickets, it's one day only worth of tickets, maximum 1,000 at $1 coin in per ticket. So if you can play $1,000 coin in, you can have as many tickets as anybody else. Free video poker classes will begin Tuesday, September 10th at noon in the showroom. At the Palms, there are drawings 8 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays with a theme of $120,000 big deal. The first five winners win between $500 and $5,000, depending on which envelope they pick. Winners 6 through 10 receive $500. There is a buyout possibility. If you get called in the top five, you may take $650 guaranteed instead of between $500 and $5,000. I don't think anybody has taken the guarantee so far. If they made it $800 guarantee, it'd still be a good bet to pass the guarantee and go for the $5,000. But at that price, at least some people would take the guarantee. On Fridays and Saturdays, between 8 p.m. and midnight, you receive five times drawing tickets. The PEW, Play, Earn, and Win, on Monday and Wednesday, Friday of the first half of the month, which ends next Wednesday, of a theme of automobile. The first prize is Chevron cards. You can get them for $100, $50, $25, basically at a 0.25% rate. So if you consider Chevron gas cards to be the same as cash, you're getting double points up to $68,000 three times a week. What you play on Monday goes over until Wednesday next week. On Friday, it's a new theme. It's the theme of pigskin. Everything's football related. And so it starts all over again. The top prize there is a $100 Albertsons gift card. VideoPoker.com, the daily contest for the next several days. Tomorrow, August 9th, Super Times Pay. Saturday, August 10th, Spin Poker. Sunday, August 11th, 50 Play with Super Times Pay. These daily contests have a modest $50 first prize, plus an entry in the Tournament of Champions. Once a month for the last 7 or 8 days, they have tournaments with a $500 first prize. These are a good way to experience these games and practice your skills before you actually go and play them in the casino. They do have an email form at videopoker.com. I participate in it. Next week, our guest is sports handicapper Jason Bean. We'll be talking about futures bets on the NFL football. So we have about 30 seconds to go. So, Munchkin, you're not going to be here next week. So Michael Shackelford is also going to be out of town. So I think it might be me and Jason all by ourselves. But if anybody has good questions for a sports handicapper, please send an email to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Frank B., thank you very much. This is fun. I got lots of video poker questions for you because I know you do that too.
Oh, yeah.
So good night, Richard. Good night, Frank. Go hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.